Hello. Good to talk to you. We've reached a point in our discussion of the Fourth Amendment in which we can begin to unify the pieces and lay the corpses around the stage as one would in the fifth act of the tragedy. It isn't that we have nothing to hope for the outcome of the process, but we cannot rely upon the constitutional provisions of the late 18th century to do our work for us, and it may be argued that this is not that profound a tragedy, but I do want to pay respects to the nobility of the Fourth Amendment, which unfortunately we come to bury rather than, at least ultimately, to praise. The course of our inquiry so far, which matches the history and the text of that one sentence, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects from unreasonable search and seizure shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause appointed by oath or affirmation, and etc. We recognize that where we are in the world with our Constitution at any given moment is best described as alone. That is to say, it isn't for Alexander Hamilton or James Madison or any of the rest of the collection of people who voted in the first Congress for legislation designed to entrench rights in a Bill of Rights that would prevent the federal layer of the empire from using the force it had been given to govern the republic and to subdue the continent, to subdue instead the people by a process of ordering the ordinary keepers of public order to do villainy, or at least thuggery. We've seen how this deeply important and carefully felt set of 18th century legal principles comes up against a world unimaginably transformed by technological change into one in which the political economy of thuggery is instead the political economy of mass surveillance, and the process of deploying officers against persons, houses, papers, and effects is secondary to the process of deploying platforms to collect whatever can be collected, which can then be put to the use of the state through processes far less complicated and expensive than what we called in the 18th century search and seizure. We haven't had occasion to this point to reflect specifically upon the nature of the transformation of surveillance by technology. The underlying phenomenon which links both law and the Internet Society, quote, course taught by me, with computers, privacy, and the Constitution, close quote, of course, taught by me, is an underlying reality about which, from a young age, I had something to do with creating, and which has changed the nature of the human race within less than 20 years. The premise underlying this inquiry and its companion, then, is that we have created an extraskeletal nervous system embracing the entire species, which we call the Internet for historical reasons, and which in the next generation will form every human mind from birth until death in direct contact, not only with that nervous system, that is the anatomy which interconnects everybody on Earth actually or potentially all the time through digital switching and the powers of software, but the physiology created by the particular software involved in that nervous system, which embraces a software entity with multiple organs that I call the parasite with the mind of God, and which collects all human behavior that it can reach, which will in the next generation be all human behavior, pretty much everywhere, pretty much all the time, and which secretes hormones in the digital nervous system to produce, to stimulate, to incentivize, to incur more behavior. It does this by secreting all the things that cause human behavior, little aerosolized droplets of sex and violence, and things to buy and own and to adorn oneself with and to become more like, and people whose vacations one can envy, and all the various other elements connected with certain primitive emotions, envy, aggression, humiliation, which are instanted in organs of the parasite, the things we call Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and Tencent's WeChat and so on. The beauty of the nature of this organism, living within the anatomy we have created, is that it has attached capitalist outcomes to the collection of human behavioral information through the form of influence of minds on minds and now of software on minds called advertising, which it has perfected as a system of moment-to-moment behavioral intervention in each individual human being's life through neurons that we call smartphones, which both collect all the behavior using a denser array of sensors than humankind has ever built before, gram for gram, including in its most sophisticated spy satellites, and which also now has a full range of behavior influencing, quote, notification modes, beeping, buzzing, vibrating, playing you music, interrupting this program to give you a special bulletin, etc., etc. This is relevant to the way every human being lives and thinks, as well as to the way every human being will be governed in the next generation. And among the elements of the governance involved is that large-scale private power now acquires all human behavior, more or less, everywhere, all the time. And because it is private business, it is accessible both to bargaining and force on the part of the state. That's the factual underlying premise on which all the various forms of analysis in this and other offerings of mine proceed, and though, of course, like all other assumptions in academic and social thought, these assumptions can be questioned, I must say that they are less questioned now by the human race in general, by several orders of magnitude, than they were when I first started purporting them, along with my comrade and colleague Richard Stallman, for the purpose of changing the way we made software in the world, a process called the Free Software Movement, which was in itself an intermediate goal. By changing the way we made software in the world, we could cause software to respect the rights of users of computers for the purpose of preventing those users of computers from being enwrapped in a form of authoritarianism that looks very much like now. The problem was that we didn't understand fully how deeply our way of making software would be co-opted by the human capitalist entities creating collectively among them the parasite with the mind of God, although we did foresee that when the states involved themselves with such systems of behavior collection, the result would be transformatively bad. So here we are in the world that was made by the entities of capitalism, the Googles and the Facebooks and the Tencents, all of whom used our free software and also our free software mode of making software to make their own software, which populated the anatomy of the network that is the interspecies-wide nervous system that collects and connects us all. They used our software and our political economy of making software to create the parasite with the mind of God, and now the largest private intelligence services on Earth are larger than the largest public intelligence services on Earth and collect far more individual human behavior than even the most adept listeners in the world of government listening. Now, to be sure, the government listeners scrape Facebook every 24 hours and place it all in the great government, that is US government, Google, called Bluffdale, Utah, and the merger of those two processes at every level, technical and political and personal and intellectual, is going faster and faster every day and will be complete under the proprietary eye of the Chinese Communist Party in the second largest economy on Earth very shortly. It is already functioning sufficiently to create a comprehensive social credit system, for example, which ties all behavior in relation to money and credit into a process of government surveillance and decision making. That won't happen in the United States this generation, in all likelihood, if we continue narrowly to escape the death of democracy. But how this plays out among the four largest societies on Earth, that of the United States, the European Union, the People's Republic of China, and the government of Federal India, will determine what the whole shape of the human race's life experience and government is by the end of the 21st century, when the species-wide nervous system has completed its development and every human organism is part of the anthill, connected by the network and run by the physiology of its software from birth until death. The premise of this course, uniquely among the various offerings that participate in the assumptions of that predicate, the predicate of this course is that the relationship between state and citizen is inevitably and unfortunately not positively transformed by this development in ways that put pressure on every system of constitutional law and the preservation of individual liberty. The network and the form of anatomy is uniform across the race, pretty much. The software, which is the physiology, varies from society to society somewhat among polar models set by the Chinese Communist Party's determination to give the middle name party to the internet. That is, to use the physiology produced by software to make that nervous system a principal organ and infrastructure of party government and therefore party domination of society, and the American model of full-throated support for what Shoshana Zuboff calls surveillance capitalism, which, as she has pointed out recently in an important piece in the New York Times I asked you to read, is in the long run incompatible with democracy. Which puts, again, just to be brief about it, further strain on the constitutional law that in the United States protects democracy, but which, in whatever form it exists in every other society, also protects the values, such as they may be, which predated the onset of the species-wide nervous system from the physiology we have endowed it with in our respective corners of the world. We've just completed the first inquiry into the relationship between the deep structure of one part of American constitutional law, hitherto very important in that process, and current circumstances. And therefore, here we are at Act 5 of the tragedy of the Fourth Amendment. Now, what we need, as I say, to begin with is to understand the form in which the onset of the new networked society affects what we have previously thought of as surveillance, which affected what we previously thought of the Fourth Amendment, by forcing, through the 20th century, a fundamental change in the Fourth Amendment's importance from low to high. Taken in the steps of response to telephony and to circuit-switched listening, and then to the incorporation of the Fourth Amendment in the Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, which subjected not just the federal imperial level of policing in the United States, but all policing in the United States to the Fourth Amendment, whatever it meant, in an era of surveillance, what that meant. What surveillance meant was listening to circuits, as we were discussing on the pad last time. That is to say, banana clip surveillance, somewhere physical clips were applied to a particular circuit in a particular telephone system, thus causing some conversations to be routed over those banana clips to an interception location, where a policeman working subject to a warrant, specifically describing the conversations to be listened to, and specifically excluding other forms of conversations had either by non-target persons or including conversations with lawyers on the same circuit who had to turn a tape recorder on and off in order to make tapes which appropriately documented would ultimately be admissible as evidence or refused admission in criminal trial, on the grounds that the processes of listening to that circuit had not appropriately met constitutional requirements as established by the warrant. That's surveillance. It involves government deciding what it needs to acquire, making provision for the issuance of orders by magistrates, and implementing those orders so as to acquire what it needs. Physical interception of conversations, surveillance, differs from the form in which government decides what it needs and with light but theoretically important judicial supervision, subject, for example, to process to quash, to eliminate judicial permission, can by subpoena, a form originating in the equity side of English jurisprudence, an order acting in personam to require cooperation by the submission of documents and testimony, on the basis of a general obligation to facilitate the work of the courts, an order from the sovereign requiring disclosure, a process which, from the point of view of the 20th century policeman, gathers a lot of evidence jurors may eventually see, but it's the tapes that do the convicting. Surveillance, then, became crucially important to 20th century American policing, and not just to American policing. And from Silverthorne on, the role of the federal courts in policing that activity under the Fourth Amendment required already some specific and complex judgments about the relationship between 18th century searching and 20th century surveillance, most of which left a significant gap, which incorporation then filled, not with supply, but with demand, as all the practices of mid to late 20th century policing became justiciable on a constitutional basis, and all searches and seizures had to be not unreasonable. under those circumstances, both United States against Katz and Title III of the 1968 Omnibus Crime Control Act, which gave the warrant for the surveillance of telephonic communications, effectively reestablished a form of constitutional law. The form of constitutional law had the statutory element that it was the Title III interception warrant that created, in the federal courts, the power to listen, which then had to meet, in general, Fourth Amendment requirements of the sufficiency of the warrant and the reasonableness of the minimization. But all of it assumes the specificity, ultimately, of a person and a conversation, a thing to be seized. To be sure, conversations could be dealt with in some general fashion. The interception warrant, which would be in its, the interception application, which would be in itself supported by a series of affidavits from prosecutors and police, would explain the criminal scheme supposedly going on and the nature of the conversations to be intercepted in the larger sense around that criminal scheme. That met the specificity requirement. These were conversations about specific illegal activities understood by the prosecutors to be occurring in part over a particular telephone line. All of this was subject to some variability after the beginning of the 21st century, when the spread of mobile telephone technology and the ease of switching phones gave rise to a law enforcement desire for roving wiretap warrants, which would allow them to attack any circuit on which some of these communications were occurring. A loss of specificity supposedly required by the nature of the technical complexity. Once, after all, we did have a strong encryption for personal communications in American society, an activity which the police and the spies both tried to prevent, and which is the source of the crypto wars in the first round, won by us, by Philip Zimmerman's pretty good privacy, and by the lawyers who, along with me, did everything we could to prevent Mr. Zimmerman from being sent to jail, and thereby created, ultimately, the grounds of the government's surrender, allowing strong encryption for interpersonal communications in the United States and, ultimately, in all the democratic societies. Now, of course, we are going through another round of the police and the spooks trying to prevent that from actually being effective by demanding that the technology be undermined by government listening opportunities, and we need to be able to get a warrant to hear everything said on WhatsApp, and so on. But in truth, we passed through, at the beginning of the 21st century, a boundary which makes all the little arguments about the specificity in relation to the Fourth Amendment, well, not just little, but microscopically irrelevant. We don't do circuit-switched listening anymore. We don't do circuit-switched listening anymore for a technical reason. Our networks aren't circuit-switched networks anymore. They're packet-switched networks. And over those networks, consisting of carriers which are as complicated as glass fibers a thousandth the width of a human hair carrying a million telephone conversations, and in which the switching equipment is not stepper bar electromechanical structures housed in exchanges full of electricity and heat, but rather in digital computers, general purpose, internet-connected Linux kernel-running computers, which are simply taking packets and sorting them out in nanoseconds and moving them down one pipe or another according to the switch's physiology, the software in the switch, which says who gets what, where, when, how, at what cost, under what restrictions, for how long, in buildings full of electricity and heat. But at least in theory, uniformly distributed across every surface and inside every enclosure in the society. The result of all that packet movement is what we have come to call mass surveillance, but that's an unfortunate rhyme. It makes us think about a similarity when it is the difference, which is really crucially important to us. In the world of packet switch networks, what the powerful do is they collect all the packets. And collecting all the packets within their reach that they can get, beg, borrow, hack, tap, or steal, they then acquire what we would be inclined nowadays in this simple neologism of ours to call big data, on which they then perform what we have come to call data science, by which we mean simplified statistics. Easier math with extraordinary amounts of information all being subjected to the vast processing power which inexpensive silicon technologies make possible for us. The American listeners, the best team in the world, funded more deeply than any imperial police has ever been funded since Augustus made the posts and the roads. The American listeners began late in the 20th century, in the last quarter of the 20th century, to do far less code breaking than they wanted us to believe they did, and far more big data collection and analysis than anybody else on Earth. A good deal of what is now called data science and has been reinvented at Google and elsewhere in the 21st century was first invented behind the classified walls in the American listeners' domain in the 80s and even the late 70s, and was embodied in a whole classified domain of mathematics for which now some senior people coming to the ends of their careers would very much like to have a little bit of credit, which has had some interesting effects in revising our understanding of the history of big data and data science. But for the moment, let us just point out that what the policemen came to call in their flatfoot way connecting the dots is not the same thing as going out and searching apartments looking for drugs, weapons, and contraband cash. The process of connecting the dots means collecting all the dots, billions and trillions of dots in advance, and later going back and sifting through them in order to make what are called connections, which is actually the process of data telling you things you didn't know you were looking for, which is what business intelligence and data science are, making data know what it knows that human beings don't yet know the data knows that they would like themselves to know. So mass surveillance is essentially the analysis of bulk collection. And bulk collection has been outsourced in society to the contractors of privacy invasion, who are the behavior collectors operating as organs of the parasite with the mind of God for the purpose of knowing whether what you want next is an egg roll or a piece of fried chicken or a sale on fragrances, including the one you like to smell like. Right now, 50 meters away, buzz, push, nudge, click, swipe, sell. Those capitalists of surveillance, but really, actually, those capitalists of behavior collection, those strip miners of the human consciousness, those entities collect what government ultimately wants to know. And whether it does so by getting, buying, bargaining for, hack, tapping, or stealing, government will have. In some cases, government will have it because it issues direct authoritarian orders and then builds bureaucracy to receive. In other societies, government both sometimes issues orders and sometimes makes deals and sometimes steals what it has failed to get a deal for. government refers to an entity like ATT by its code name at the National Security Agency, which has been for decades Fair Play. That is, AT&T offers fair play to the listeners as they see it. But whatever the particulars of the way in which money marries power in this area, marry it will. And whether it is the importance of an entity like Facebook to the smaller secret police of the world, we know everybody you are looking for. You don't know what their names are, but you know what they're like. You can use us to find them. Or whether it is the power relationship at the pinnacle of each of the societies that can afford an excellent team and also has powerful surveillance capitalism in the market, whether it is Google eating lunch at the White House once a week, or the relation between the Chinese cyberspace administration and the companies in the club, or whether it is the Kremlin and Yandex, the important point, after all, is that government power and private power meet where the elite meet to eat, and eat they do. The telecoms are an important part of this process everywhere because they have all the so-called metadata. They connect everybody to everybody else, and they move a ton of packets. We are generally conditioned to think that metadata is somehow less than data. Oh, we're only taking metadata. Oh, this is only metadata we are talking about. The point that Mishy and I made in the Times of India piece about WhatsApp and Signal on this point, I'd like to just make sure we have fully taken aboard within the context of the Fourth Amendment. Privacy, this word we use, is actually a portmanteau. It contains analytically divisible entities that we should see separately that merge together to make what we call privacy. First, there is secrecy, which we can define specifically. A signal or a message or a set of packets are secret if the content of those packets can only be known to the sender and the intended recipients of those packets. Secrecy is a basic property of privacy. Without the ability to keep secrets, all other forms of privacy are impossible. And hence, we worry about access to the content of packets, our telephone conversations, our chats, our emails, and so on. The second component of privacy is anonymity. Anonymity is the property of a message or a packet set or a signal when, even if the content of that signal is knowable, the maker and the intended recipients of that signal are only known to them. If the identities surrounding a message are obscure, and they may be obscure not because they are anonymous in the sense that no identity is proposed. They may be pseudonymous in the sense that an identity is proposed which is arbitrary and unmeaningful to bystander observers. If the endpoints of a signal are obscure, then what has been defeated is knowledge of identities. The ability to link particular signals or communications to all the other behavior associated with an identity, the process that is of searching persons, papers and effects, not as the result of a warrant targeted at an identity, but as the result of a comprehensive attempt to understand every individual human action and to attribute it somewhere to somebody. This, the attribution of everything, which is the only reliable basis for deterrence in the strategic thinking of contemporary powerful societies trying to deal with asymmetric threats and hybrid warfare and domestic terrorism and all the other forms of badness they wish to confront for reasons of public interest or for reasons of their own. This process of attributing everything destroys privacy and ultimately undermines democracy for reasons that Shoshana Zuboff has presented to you. And it occurs because metadata is compromised. The secrecy of metadata is the anonymity of persons. If every communication, if every packet is attributable, then sooner or later, all the patterns of behavior which make up our communications with one another become part of the data resources of the analysts of government. Also of private parties. Hence, it becomes impossible for us to have the third and most important form of our privacy, which is our autonomy. Autonomy can be defined as our power to make and effectuate the decisions important to us in our lives without the influence of violations of our secrecy and anonymity. In other words, when our secrecy is broken and the content of our communications and behavioral actions are disclosed, and or when our anonymity is compromised and our identity is attributably linked to actions and behaviors we had no desire to have attributed to us by anybody, then what is immediately compromised in the larger and more complex sense is our ability to make our life decisions and to do what we want to do and have in at least in the basis of a society which believes that anything not forbidden is permitted, as ours does, right to autonomous activity. The language of the Fourth Amendment is consistent with this understanding of the goal we are seeking in society. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable search and seizure. But it cannot effectuate that promise because it assumes search and seizure of a certain kind, and it assumes a society in which search and seizure primarily must in the end be directed against the people whose rights that unreasonable search and seizure violates. The society of mass behavior data acquisition, not mass surveillance now, because surveillance has come to mean the forces of law enforcement and espionage retroactively analyzing vast collections of behavioral material already made by them or by others to whom they have access. The process of mass behavior collection followed ex post by forms of mathematical analysis that any party with immense resources can apply to all the data they can gather. That society conducts search and seizure in a new and completely different sense, in which the actions of the third-party comprehensive behavior collectors and memorizers are the crucial changed element. The purpose to which the Fourth Amendment was addressed across the many different circumstances that arose in the Anglo-American world from 1650 to the end of the 20th century are not the circumstances for which we now need law to help us regulate the behavior of the state and the organs of law enforcement and espionage. In one sense, it is clear enough what needs to be done. The residual placiness of the Fourth Amendment needs to give way to an understanding that search and seizure are location-independent activities. All of the complexity of late 20th century Fourth Amendment law, whether it is Kilo's attempt to figure out whether you can go inside the house without going inside the house because you are using newfangled infrared imaging technology, or whether it is Dow Chemical's attempt to figure out whether old-fashioned technology like binoculars mixed with old-fashioned or medium-fashioned or even newfangled technology like a helicopter or a hot air balloon for floating over the fence instead of going through it, or whether it is Riley's extraordinary interest in the neuron, the phone itself, as opposed to everything else that it is part of, or whether it is the complexity of trying to understand whether location tracking done by sticking a thing to a car is fundamentally different from location tracking done by getting GPS data out of a billion phones. The games of late 20th century Fourth Amendment law, even the ones that aren't as pitiful as the closed container in plain sight and the open car and the open container not in plain sight and the trunk of the car and all of this represented portions of the thought process of making the specificity of 18th century Fourth Amendment language its crowning glory, its real legal purpose, what it had achieved because it had embedded an understanding of the history of thuggery from Carrington's case to the last of the pieces of the exclusionary rule dismissed by the good faith breadth of Herring against the United States. All of this simply doesn't matter anymore. Now, there is, in, let us say, the efforts of Sonia Sotomayor to collect some votes, there is clearly a theory on the Supreme Court that something needs to be done about this. And Carpenter, for all its absolute incoherence as a case and its wrongfulness as a result, is, as people in their optimism have tried to make work for themselves, some indication that it isn't just Justice Sotomayor who knows that the game is somehow fallen on its side and all the pieces have been ruptured. The chief knows it too. The effort in Carpenter to draw a line is ridiculous. The line is A, not sound, B, in the wrong place, C, not really made of ink, etc., etc. I've indicated why it is that I think Carpenter is ridiculously wrongly decided. But it's not merely that it's wrongly decided. It's that we cannot actually get from the Fourth Amendment's language to the thing we need. What we need, we could, to some extent, supply by statute. And later in this course, I'm going to try and lay out what the sort of non-constitutional statutory structures are that the United States in particular, or other legal systems in the world, can use to address comprehensively the nature of the citizen's state difficulty, or at any rate, the citizen's difficulty with the empowerment of the state, under 21st century conditions. But it's worth working out just for a moment the premise that more than a premise, like Hamlet's end, the premise and a stage full of bodies lying prone that I want to get from the tragedy of the Fourth Amendment. That is why, even if we have five votes on the United States Supreme Court, we can't use them for what we want. The immediate premise, I think, that rises to everybody's mind is we need to define unreasonable in a new way. And you can certainly imagine writing something, a landmark opinion, that would explain why it is unreasonable to do various things. And the problem, as Carpenter suggests, is you have to figure out which those things are and how to describe which ones they are without making incoherence out of it one thing that is unreasonable at a time. In other words, the power of the concept of unreasonable search and seizure as a common law structure to be defined case by case and line by line and search by search and cop by cop, which is at least the premise after Map Against Ohio, that premise won't work here. If we were actually to attempt the recategorization of unreasonable in the world of the 21st century, we couldn't do it one lump of data at a time. We actually would need to find the principle that underlies the difference between reasonable and unreasonable. And at that point, it's not the Fourth Amendment as we've known it, but it requires a great intellectual leap, but that's not the difficulty. There's no landing zone for the leap. The reason that that's true is that it's not merely that unreasonable needs redefining. Search has already been redefined. And rather than the execution of the warrant, it's the delivery of the subpoena. We need to recognize the primacy of the third party. Now the question, what is unreasonable with respect to asking questions of third parties with respect to information they have acquired in the course of their business in which law enforcement has an interest? The problem is that, well, it's not unreasonable. In other words, the difficulty becomes explaining why it is unreasonable for government to ask questions of third parties, which third parties have either a legal duty to answer or no legal duty to refuse to answer, when what is being sought is in no way in violation of the rights of the parties to whom the order is addressed. Now, a statute can do this. In fact, a statute actively does. A remarkable work of the mid-1970s in the United States called the Family and Educational Records Privacy Act, colloquially known as the Buckley Amendment, after Senator James Buckley of Connecticut, the brother of the famous American right-wing thinker William F. Buckley, who was, in the libertarian sense, an advocate of privacy in the United States Senate at a time when the issue didn't yet exist. FERPA gives to students the right to go to court and quash educational records subpoenas issued to educational institutions. That is to say, if a university is served with a subpoena in civil or criminal litigation asking for educational records of a student, then the university has an obligation to notify the student, who has a right to go to court to challenge the subpoena. This is an unusual example of what we can suppose we would need to make uniform throughout American law with respect to notification and right to contest and opportunity to challenge every subpoena for every kind of record which could conceivably be said to be an unreasonable search under some new definition of unreasonable if issued to the third party possessing the information. And despite the fact that this sounds like an enormous victory we could have with a congressional majority, and does indeed have to play a role in the post-constitutional structure of surveillance protection, whether we are talking about a statute in America that doesn't exist yet or a data protection statute in India that could exist if the current data protection law on its way towards a speedy passage now hadn't been written by the surveillance capitalists of India, etc. If we imagine something designed in this context to subject spying and law enforcement mass surveillance to the rule of law, but we need to recognize that the reason that the Buckley Amendment seems to succeed, and the history of its enforcement doesn't suggest that it is much more than seeming. The reason it succeeds is the narrowness of its definitions. The present subpoena for educational records to an educational institution, when the full process of automating the collection of all the behavior has occurred, or is even as far along as it has occurred now in the United States, the issue isn't the subpoena for one thing. It's the scraping of everything and the conduct of government analysis of everything on the basis of real-time feeds from everywhere. And the idea of procedural challenge to a particular subpoena comes to look almost as obsolete as the belief that it's going to be done by a warrant issued to an officer by a magistrate. So part of our difficulty is that even the redefinition of unreasonable to include conduct inviting third-party cooperation won't suffice, because the layer of the invitation, the layer at which the invitation to third-party cooperation occurs, whether it is official, unofficial, legal, or extra-legal, dwarfs the ability of any particular party to respond to it. Unless, of course, we think it's all about the exclusionary rule. But everybody who wants to point out that the exclusionary rule seems insufficient outside the context of the limited political economy of thuggery understands why that too won't suffice for us. And why the process of attributing and deterring misconduct in a world of third-party behavior acquisition requires us not to worry about the exclusionary rule in the criminal prosecution, but to police the behavior of what has come to be called big tech, which it appears politicians of all stripes in the United States have recognized they cannot easily police. Nor can we sufficiently shed from the Fourth Amendment all of its attractive requirements for specificity. Specificity is the 18th century solution to the 18th, 19th, and 20th century problem. But it's the empty cliche of law with respect to the problems of the 21st. We don't need specificity. We need clever generality and deep commitment to new principles of restraint. For these purposes, our own technical judgments and opportunities are really important. It's our ability to use technology in such a way as to benefit ourselves, to restore our secrecy and anonymity and therefore our autonomy, which is the growth area in this. Not in the law, because no matter how many votes on the Supreme Court we get, we can't make things happen by judicial opinion that need to occur. And as I will show, though we can do a great deal with powerful congressional majorities in order to impose additional civil and criminal burdens on thuggery in an attempt to change the political economy of thuggery back again into one in which the citizen has a chance, we can't really do that well enough to avoid the need for the citizens themselves to take some role in the protection of their rights. Most of the world is mystified by the American belief that the most important technology for taking back rights is guns. This is an outgrowth of American political economy of other forms too, which we will maybe slide by a little bit in the course of thinking the issues through that motivate us in this course. But by and large, guns are an analog technology and we have little to do with them. But we should observe the particular oddity, not only in American thinking, but in thinking about freedoms in the digital age around the world, how much of the time the emphasis falls on the technology on the dark side and how little of it falls on the technology of the light side. We can, as was suggested on the pad last time, minimize the ways in which we leave behavioral data in the third-party hands in the outside world, and maximize the ways in which we route the data important to us in our lives, which isn't the behavioral dandruff we can simply decide not to shed, but the important data that is crucial, our persons, houses, papers, and effects of 21st century life, we can route those into computers which rest in the places where we as people have rights that continue to be important. If you want my mail, if you want my chats, if you want my behavior data, it's sitting on spindles in servers in my apartment. Get a warrant. It's my home. The extent, in other words, to which what we have available in order to meet the constitutional aspirations we still possess is less the Constitution and its law and less the politics of whether Congress will get around to helping us and more the technology we ourselves use to make our rights real. The tragedy of the Fourth Amendment could have been the comedy of free software, still is for me. The best teams in the world, if they want to break into my life, will. I don't doubt it. They're very good. They are enormously powerful, and they have a lot of dough. But they will have to come for me specially. Breaking into my network, stealing my cloud, analyzing the droplets within my cloud means you've got to meet me on the technology I chose, the smallest possible attack surface that I completely understand. If I make a mistake, that mistake will redound to the benefit of the best teams in the world because they remorselessly capitalize on mistakes if they're looking. If they're there, make them do it retail. Each of us, a few billion people, having slightly modified the way we use technology so as to have increased our secrecy, protected our anonymity, kept as much of our metadata and as much of the content of our communications out of the hands of everybody else, even if all of Zoom's servers are in the United States and are subject to FERPA when they are used to teach law school, even if they aren't also in China, even if pinging isn't going on all over the place and metadata isn't being captured and the recordings of all those communications between teachers and students aren't being saved everywhere, even if it were all in the United States and subject all to American law, the teaching of law school by Zoom is an obscenity. If we are having a video conversation in your life and mine, if it's at office hours or a discussion group and we're conducting it over my meet.moglen.us Jitsi Meet server, no record of those bits is ever being kept anywhere. The secrecy of the communications is as protected as HTTPS is protected, which is pretty good against everything except active listening by the best teams on Earth. And there is no leakage from my server about anything. The metadata of who was connected is not leaked anywhere. The content of the conversations is as evanescent as the air molecules in a room in which there aren't any microphones. It's not that we can't do it. It's that we don't. So one of the things which the tragedy of the Fourth Amendment stands for is that 18th century conceptions do not necessarily survive. Not at the level of detail where common law decision making can reach them, but at the level of deep fundamental social concepts where the law itself suffers from unself-consciousness. And where changes of scale and political economy can make even concepts not yet obsolete inadministrable, so that both the law and politics cease to provide short or medium-term solutions to pressing problems. But technology, which is not paced or structured as either the politics or the law, may have other consequences and be available for purposes not otherwise attainable. This is why every subject that we analyze necessarily from the three perspectives of technology and politics and law, from the history of each to the reality of now in each. But freedom is hard. Constitutional law is very easy to the big domes who teach it in law school, and very easy to expect the not so big domes who don't teach in law school to defer to the Supreme Court as the keeper of the national ideals. But freedom is hard to keep when freedom requires that people understand in their own lives the specifics of what it is that makes them either free or unfree. This is why men who own slaves could think of themselves as thinkers in liberty, people of liberty, creators of constitutional republics in the late 18th century in America. Thinking high is sometimes far easier than thinking low. Thomas Jefferson is aware of the internal conflict presented by the nature of his political ideals and the condition of his and the linked lives of slaves he owned in Virginia. In the notes on Virginia, he of course can explain why slavery cannot be abolished in the Declaration of Independence, while at the same time recognizing that his own doubts, we must call them that, they don't prevent him from having slaves in multiple senses. His doubts cannot be published in his lifetime. I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just. Here, in the world of the mass surveillance of the 21st century and the obsolescence of the Fourth Amendment, the ethics are the ethics of self-government, not the ethics of recognizing enslavement and destroying it everywhere. Not even the complex ethics of equality, which still elude the society which claims above its courthouse doors to be rendering equal justice under law, but the supposedly simpler problem of the freeing of oneself. After all, nobody makes you carry the so-called smartphone. And nobody makes you buy at price zero in return for all your behavior data, the trivial services, email, calendaring, social sharing, photo sharing, that you buy at the cost of yourselves. Nobody forces the situation in which you set up most of that surveillance, but sometimes they do. They impose choices upon you which are essentially unconstitutional conditions if you believe that third-party searchable memorization of all your behavior is in some way unconstitutional. And you have to stop it. And you have to teach other people how to stop. We have to raise the village better now that we can't just assume that its thugs are going to be subject to Fourth Amendment control. Fortunately, not everything is obsolete in the Bill of Rights, and from here we can turn to tools that not only still work, but might even work better, even for these purposes. So, beginning next time, the comedy of the First Amendment rather than the tragedy of the Fourth. Talk to you soon.